Elise Glink joins us, the owner of Think Glink Media and Best Money Moves. She's the co-host of This Week in Wealth with Tom Fortino. That's on WGN Radio, Sundays at 7 a.m., thinkglink.com. Hey, Elise, welcome back. And what's your read on the mood out there right now?
You know, it's interesting, John. I got an email from a listener to This Week in Wealth, and she said, listen, I understand you guys manage money for people. I don't, actually, but certainly Tom Fortino does. She said, but I had to move out of my home of 40 years because my rent went up by $400 in 1 year. And last week, the Wall Street Journal just, you know, posted a poll that said the vast majority of people don't think life is going to be better for their kids. And it feels just like there's one survey after one poll after one research piece after another that's just saying the same thing. People are not feeling positive about the economy.
Is that because the numbers bear it out, or is there something else at play here?
You know, it's interesting. I actually think it's both. I think there's some real pain, and it goes beyond, you know, just inflation and what's going on with inflation. In December, Pew Research Foundation found that 25% of U.S. parents, a quarter of people, struggled to afford food or housing over 2022. That's a quarter of U.S. Americans. So the pain is real, and even the money that the government had passed along to everybody in the pandemic was also real, but it feels like the good feelings that people had from that income boost and even the money that they're making at their jobs just doesn't seem to be enough to overcome what's really going on at, you know, price at the pump, so to speak.
That at a time when unemployment is still below 4%. I mean, that's, I believe what you're saying, but you would think that one would sort of mitigate the other.
Yeah, you would think that it would. And the fact that gas prices have come down, you know, back into the $3.50, sometimes it's $3.35, sometimes I pay $3.85, but I haven't paid over $4 in a really long time. You would think that those two things would go together and make people feel better. But, you know, it was interesting. In the Washington Post today, it broke down sort of the psychological toll that there seems to be, a very real thing, that people are spending so much of their free time planning how they're going to save 10 cents, 50 cents, 50 bucks, that it's exhausting. And that there seems to be this negative correlation between amount of time you have to spend thinking about your money to make it last long enough and the satisfaction you feel by actually saving the money and making your budget work. And it's fascinating.
I'm thinking about what the CEO, Bernie Marcus, the founder and the co-founder of Home Depot, said recently, and I'm going to get to that in a second, but he said that people are lazy, they don't want to work hard enough, etc. And I, you know, was having this argument with him in my head. I mean, he's got his point and he lays it out well, but I thought maybe people would want to work at Home Depot more if you paid them more. I guess I'm reminded of that article because you're saying that while employment, say, is 97%, people are still having trouble struggling. And I'm wondering if that means we should pay people more or they should spend, you know, I don't know what the solution to that is.
Well, I think we have to make people happier about the jobs that they're doing. And I think there's a lot of stuff that's going on right now that's focused on it. And I see a lot of it happening in the benefits world as the CEO of Best Money Moves, my financial wellness company, because people are finally, employers are finally connecting the idea that, yes, people work to pay their bills. I know that seems sort of obvious, John, but, you know, that fact seems to escape people that not only do they want to pay their bills, but, oh, and I really want to feel like I'm making a meaningful contribution here.
Yeah.
And those are important pieces.
Fair enough. And I think that is the lesson that we all learned, that we can all afford too, right? Employers can afford that. And employees might be willing to take a little less if they felt like I was a little happier at my work. But I think also nagging me and just hanging over this is the idea that, hey, you made a billion. You are a billionaire thanks to Home Depot. It was your idea. You worked hard and God bless you. You know, you win. But if you have $1 billion and you can't seem to get people to work in your store, maybe you should not have $1 billion. Maybe you should have $500 million, spread the wealth, and maybe that would help not only make people happier, but also solve some of these problems for people that earn less than $60,000 a year.
Yeah, agree completely. And I know we have to take a quick break, but I would love to dig into what the Washington Post broke out today, because I think that when we think about inflation, we think it was 9% last year, now it's 6%. I should feel better when I go to the grocery store, but so many people don't. And it was really an insightful expose in some ways about what the true cost, the true pain at the pump actually is.
One of our listeners texted in to say, hey, can you ask Elise if it is really necessary to charge 31% interest on a credit card? What's the reaction to that?
I'm just sorry. Let me stop chortling. No, it is not necessary for companies to charge 31%. Here's the problem, though. They have what's known as a margin. It's a little bit like what happens with mortgages. So if you can borrow money at 2% from the Fed, you would charge 4% or 5% in a mortgage. So if it goes up to 3% or now 4 or 5%, that's how you end up with 7 or 8% interest rates on loans. When it comes to credit cards, the reason the company credit cards, and this is not saying at all that they can't afford to bring that down. Of course they can. But first they have the money that they pay, you know, the cost that they pay for that money. And then they also have to factor in all the people who don't make their payments and let those cards lapse. And then they end up going to collections. And so part of the reason that the interest rate is higher from credit card companies is they have to cover the losses that they actually have. And when interest rates go up, lots more people stop paying their credit card bills, and they don't pay the interest, and they don't pay off those balances, and so credit card companies have to make up for it. And that's one of the reasons that you see that interest rate jump.
I understand that, and I don't know what the answer to this is, but they say, okay, so we're going to charge some people a lot, and the people that will pay the highest interest rates will be the people who are least able to pay off their balances, or that are starting out with a higher rate because they've got a worse credit score. So it's kind of upside down, isn't it? Not that people who pay their bills on time with good credit scores should be penalized for it, but hey, banks, the reason these people are using their credit cards and have bad scores is because they do have trouble paying their bills, and so you can't get blood out of a turnip. Those are the people least able to pay 30%, and they're the ones being charged 30%.
Yeah, it's a real issue, John, because you're exactly right. People who can least afford it end up getting charged the most. And that's why, you know, at Best Money Moves, we spend a lot of energy and also on This Week in Wealth with John, trying to educate people on how to make smarter decisions so they have a higher credit score. Some of the things that happened over the last year, though, should have helped raise credit scores for a lot of people. A new law went into effect that required credit card credit reporting bureaus to stop giving as much weight to medical debt. And lots of people have medical debt that isn't really medical debt, John. It's the insurance companies fighting with the carriers, fighting with the hospitals, fighting with your doctor to try and figure out who's going to pay for what. And that process could take a year or more. And so what Congress did essentially is decide that credit reporting bureaus weren't going to be able to look at that the same way. And so as a result, a lot of people had a higher credit score after that went into effect. I think it was the beginning of the year.
Can you talk about, I'm also looking here at three families, real expenses. I think this goes back to the people making less than $60,000 don't pay their bills on time. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, it was interesting. So the Washington Post worked with a company that looks at receipts. And what they did is they picked out these three families and they showed how much they're actually paying, the difference based on real receipts between, let's say, onions in 2021 and onions in 2022. And so we have in our heads that costs went up 9%, but actually the change between 2021 and 2022 for onions was 29%. it was 115% for milk and 111% for eggs. And, you know, if you wanted grapes, it was 25% more and celery 31% more. When you go to restaurants, that all gets magnified. And so one of the families used to go to Denny's for lunch. A stack of pancakes in 2021 cost $2, and in 2022 it was $3.49. That's up 75%. A junior cheeseburger was $3.99 in 2021. 2022, $4.79, up 20%. And so these kinds of differences, you know, you think to yourself, well, that's just $1.49 for a stack of pancakes. But actually, for some people, for a lot of Americans earning less than $60,000 a year, that $1.49 pushes it out of the realm of affordability. Because, it, of course, it isn't just $1.49. It's $1.49 plus tax and tip, right? And it just all adds up. And so it's kind of interesting to think about it. And if you're in a person earning $60,000 a year or less, and you're not actually making ends meet, the cost of psychological cost of thinking about that, of managing that, of trying to figure out how you're going to make substitutions so that your bills are affordable, that is just really overwhelming for people. And it's clearly causing a lot of negative emotion around money.
We're all paying a lot of attention to eggs. I'm looking at this list. I didn't realize, okay, this is the guy in Henderson, Kentucky. 2021, he paid for a gallon of milk a dollar. Mm-hmm. Last year, he paid $2.15. I presume that's a gallon. Maybe that was a half gallon, whatever. Whatever the unit cost was, his milk went from $1 to $2.15. Eggs went from $2.16 to $4.56. I didn't realize milk had jumped that much. Chicken is up for people. Ground beef, I would imagine, is up, and it is across the board. Those are staples. That's not eating fancy. That's just eating, isn't it?
Yeah, well, they actually looked at Sam's Club. So you think, you know, I always say if you can go to a Sam's Club or a Costco, you know, you're certainly going to do better. You'll buy in bulk, but generally speaking, you're paying less than at a store. But what they found is that the cost of eggs at Sam's Club in 2021, probably for 18 eggs, was $3.48. In 2022, it was $7.38. That's a really big jump. It was 112%. And that is exactly the same percentage that this guy found in Henderson, Kentucky with his smaller unit. And they also found in Taramac, Florida, and also Durham, North Carolina. Everybody is paying this kind of big increase in these things, but it's just overwhelming, and all of it is more than 9%. So we in the media talk about the numbers we're given, right, from the Department of Commerce. You know, they talk about, you know, where the numbers are going up, but this is very high, and it's painful for so many of us.
These numbers float. We've got about a half a minute left here, but eggs aren't that expensive now, right? Haven't a lot of these things come down of late?
Eggs are starting to come down, but here's the thing, John, about inflation that nobody gets. If it's prices are going to come down, it's deflation, right? So overall, you get some prices going up and some going down, but they never really come back to where they were. And we're not still over the avian flu. So eggs are still in short supply to a great extent. So it never really gets cheaper.
Elise Glink is the owner of Think Glink Media and Best Money Moves. Listen for her and Tom Fortino Sunday mornings at 7 and Monday afternoons on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Nice to talk to you, Elise. Thanks for your thoughts.
Thank you, John.
Up next, Doug Kelly, CEO of the American Edge Project. AmericanEdgeProject.org is the website. Doug and company are very much involved in the tech sector and supporting them in the Chicago area. And they say right now it's kind of a challenge. The tech startups are bracing for an uphill battle in the coming months in Chicago. Why is that, Doug? Welcome to the show. What's going on here?
Hey, thanks for having me. I appreciate you being on my being on the show.
Sure, sure. Well, what's going on
I'll
in the tech sector in Chicago? Yeah.
Yeah, so let's just look at the tech sector overall, and then we'll talk about Chicago. So technology isn't just another sector of our economy, right? It is the very backbone of our national security, our economic prosperity, as well as our advancing our values, both at home and abroad. But there's some real challenges that are facing the tech sector, right? The economic downturn resulting in a lot of job losses. The second is really fierce competition from China, who's intent on taking America's technological edge. And when you add to that some kind of legislation at Congress that would handcuff some of our biggest innovators, it's a very challenging time to be in the tech sector and something that's so very important to America overall.
Hmm. What's the handcuff you're talking about? What's Congress doing to sort of stall innovation?
Sure. So in innovation, Congress can help or hurt. On the help side, when they passed the CHIPS bill, which helped create new microchips and additional factories in the country here, that was a great piece of business they did. But in the last session, what they tried to do was pass a series of bills that would restrict our largest innovators' ability to do mergers and acquisitions, to invest in certain adjacent areas, as well as in some bills, we're even breaking up our largest technology companies. And again, these aren't just small enterprises, right? These are our most important national players when it comes to winning the battle for technology against China, who is investing trillions of dollars to try and beat America when it comes to technology.
How does the SVB thing reflect on all of this?
Well, part of it, I mean, that's a huge bank for startups, right? That really matters. We've created hundreds of startup ecosystems all around this country. Chicago is a great one. But they're pretty delicate things overall. You mix good ideas with capital, with good mentors to help these entrepreneurs who do startups. And all told, it's somewhat of a risky business. And so we want to make sure our lawmakers are doing things that support these innovation ecosystems and not doing things that undermine them overall. Because at the end of the day, our biggest competitor on this is China.
I think right now the attitude is, well, we need to do more to regulate, just as a for instance, a bank or a venture capitalist because of what happened a couple of weeks ago at SVB and elsewhere. What do you think of that? I know that the bank is one thing and the businesses are another, but are those related somehow?
Yeah, they're two really separate things there. I mean, at the end of the day, our startups are our most important asset that America has, right? This is where new ideas are created and nurtured and grown. And one of the challenges is that when they're not able to get the capital that they need, these businesses starve on the vine. And as a result, sometimes they're purchased by a Chinese company, sometimes they just go under, and good ideas don't get launched. Like, I'll give you one example that's in the news a lot, right? So everybody's heard about this ChatGPT, right? That was a small startup that got a massive injection of capital from one of our biggest tech companies in America. And now that company is really becoming the world leader in artificial intelligence. And it matters that an American company is leading in one of those strategic technologies of the future and not, say, a Chinese company, because we have two very different views of our two countries do of how technology can work with a society. China's view is very controlled, censoring, and controlling, whereas America's version is a very free, open, and accessible piece that helps create new opportunities. And so
we got a wake-up call during the first of the pandemic. We thought, holy cow, we're way too reliant on foreign providers, China particularly, to manage our health care, get us the PPE or whatever it is that we need, say nothing of pharmaceuticals. So we need to be more independent that way. But I want you to tell me what we're doing wrong before you tell me what we need to do right. Like, what's an example of either a congressional roadblock or just some policy that's not a aggressive enough? What would you like to see us do more of?
Sure. What I'd like to see us do more of is to make sure that we are checking China's global reach when it comes to technology. Like, that's an important thing to do because, like I said a minute ago, China uses its technology for digital authoritarianism, right? To censor and control their population. They are aggressively exporting that model to other countries. So So one of the things we can do is we can help block that by working with our allies to discourage them from allowing China tech firms to get a big foothold in their country. Because we saw it here, you know, a couple of years ago when President Trump put some sanctions on Chinese technology companies, that, you know, many of the devices that they were putting in were actually spying on what we're doing in terms of critical infrastructure. And so kind of part one is we got to play defense against what authoritarian countries are trying to do. And then part two is we got to play great offense. And that means investing in American innovation, reducing regulations on businesses that are helping create game-changing products, doing things that protect consumers so they know where their privacy is and they know where their data is, and making sure that America maintains our technological edge in the world. It's not guaranteed. Like, we have to be able to fight for it.
Doug Kelly's the CEO of the American Edge Project. It's a coalition of technology leaders that are trying to preserve the innovative spirit in America and everything that underpins that, or that it underpins. I guess you think then TikTok should be more restricted or banned in America?
You know, it's funny. We're having a really serious debate on that here, right? About whether that should be around. Is it the federal level, at the state level, that debate is? You know where they're not having this debate? In China, where tech companies do exactly what the government tells them. And so there's a real danger in becoming over-reliant on technology that has to answer to authoritarian governments. Now, I understand you ran a poll on this the other day. What were the results of that poll?
Right down the middle. I mean, we asked if Illinois should do what Utah did. Should Illinois do what Utah did? And that is, at least for the kids' sake, restrict access to it. And half my audience said yeah.
I mean, this is a real, it's a real tough debate that's going on. You know, just last week, there were three stories in 7 days that came out about China's kind of whole of society effort to beat the U.S. in technology. You know, it involved a trial in Cincinnati that showed kind of the depth of spying that China did on American energy and aerospace industry. Another story showed that China was rejiggering its entire science, technology, and finance infrastructure to help accelerate more tech innovation. And then the third story was about these enormous port cranes, right? The things that lift the cargo off ships. 80% of those are made in China, and we have them here. And those are actually, they believe that they are actually devices on them that can monitor port traffic, who we're trading with, all from Beijing, and they could be disabled from Beijing as well. And so we, when I say our Congress and lawmakers have to take a look at who are our strategic competitors all across the globe, and then what do we have to do to make sure that we are maintaining our edge, that's really job one for them.
All right, Doug, I'm glad you're there, and let's check in another day. I mean, frankly, I think most of us don't think about it that much, or we think about it in very sort of ballpark terms, but who's drilling down and actually thinking about legislation or fiscal policy and how it impacts our company and theirs, and our economy, our companies and theirs. Doug Kelly is the CEO of the American Edge Project.org is the website. Nice to talk to you today, Doug. Thanks for your thoughts.
Thanks, John. Take care.
That's Doug Kelly. It's time to continue with more business news on the Wintrust Business Lunch with Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Online recruiting platform Glassdoor is cutting jobs at its Chicago office. The company filed a layoff notice with Illinois for 26 job cuts. The company's cutting about 15% of its workforce, or about 140 positions. Glassdoor declined to disclose how many people work at its Chicago office. The cutbacks could be another sign the economy is slowing down further. Another online recruiting site, Indeed, also has announced a 15% workforce reduction company-wide. Electric vehicle maker Rivian is reportedly bringing members of its engineering team to downstate Normal in an effort to speed up production. The Wall Street Journal reports the engineers will be responsible for the design of the factory and how it functions. That could include everything from how the machines work to help build vehicles to the layout of the assembly line. Rivian missed its 2022 production target and has laid off workers in recent months. It's unclear how many engineers might relocate to the Normal assembly facility. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Let's check on the business of food with Steve Alexander.
I've got a hypochondriac alert coming right after I tell you we're sponsored by the Chevy Silverado HD. Experience your life at HD. Visit ChevyDriveChicago.com. Okay, if you're abnormally anxious about your health, maybe you've been wondering and fretting about whether the bird flu that's killed millions of chickens and turkeys is going to spread to humans. Here to help us with that is
Connie Austin. I'm the state public health veterinarian in Illinois, working for the Illinois Department of Public Health.
And is it possible for humans to get the bird flu? Yeah, the quick answer is yes. There have been isolated cases of it around the world, but
people are most at risk of high-path avian influenza are those that actually have contact with sick birds that have it. So the general population wouldn't typically have that kind of exposure.
So if you're around poultry, she says it's a good idea to make sure you have your flu shot.
Because the seasonal flu vaccine will help reduce the chance that you'd have somebody with the seasonal flu and high-path avian influenza, which could combine a little virus from each one and cause a new virus to form.
We do not want that. So
we really want, you know, everyone to get their seasonal flu vaccine, but especially poultry owners.
And that means you, backyard chicken owners. The bird flu is largely transmitted by migratory birds, and Dr. Austin says the USDA has tips on keeping your hens from being infected by the passersby.
And that's why USDA has a program called Defend the Flock, and anybody can go look on their website and read the information about Defend the Flock. It's going to be much harder, obviously, with a backyard flock to keep wild birds away from them. But there are tips about how to go ahead and try to do that.
Okay. Dr. Connie Austin, on a scale of 1 to 10, how concerned are you about the bird flu spreading to humans?
As far as getting into the general population, I'm probably more around like a 4. But like I said, we don't want to ignore it and then have a problem. So we really do want to be as careful as we can.
Dr. Connie Austin, the public health veterinarian for the state of Illinois. Tomorrow, we will talk about what to do if you have backyard chicken buyer's remorse. From the farm to your belly, today's National Spanish Paella Day. It is also International Whiskey Day. That's the business of food on 720 WGN.
Well, this is interesting. Our last guest said we need to be wary of China. We need to better develop and encourage technological innovation in America. Chicago, too. Sharon King is actually an elementary education and curriculum expert at Mad Science. Chicago.madscience.org is the website for what Sharon's all about, speaking of innovation, technology, and STEM programming. Hi, Sharon. You're on the air. How are you?
I'm well, John. Thanks for having me on.
So these are franchise businesses across the U.S. and Canada. Is that right?
Yes, actually. We're in 23 different countries.
And what do you do? What are you selling or what service do you provide?
Absolutely. So Mad Science, we create, as you were talking about, STEM programs, so science, technology, engineering, and math. And what we do is we provide outreach programs for youth in a really, really creative, interactive way that helps them engage in the natural world and learn about foundational science, like fundamentals, like biology, chemistry, physics, and engineering, and how those things are really essential to our everyday lives.
So do districts hire you to come in and put in programs, or do you sell textbooks, equipment, technology to schools? How do you do that?
We do even more than that. So we basically send in instructors that are real live people that go in and do programming with kids. So whether it be in Chicago public schools, in after school programs, summer camps, birthday parties, even really big stage shows, we go anywhere kids are to help them engage in science.
Well, that's interesting. So instead of hiring a clown, I could hire one of your people. They'd come out, entertain the kids, and sort of surreptitiously get them a little education, huh?
It's all about surreptitious education. So basically, we're providing supplemental learning in science and inspiration at a really young age. And we think that's really important to do now because we're seeing a lot of learning loss coming out of the pandemic. So yeah. Kids, teachers, all of those people need the support now.
So give me an example of how you would engage. Where would you go? What would you do?
So I can give you a great example of Chicago Public Schools because we've stepped up our efforts there to go in and do out-of-school time programming, so after school. So we'll come into a classroom of kids And we specialize in elementary education because, again, we love that, you know, early learning in science. And we'll do a program on weather. We'll do a program on kitchen chemistry. We'll do a program on life in the sea. And we'll bring all the equipment to show the kids, you know, again, how science is done. They're not just watching it. They're doing it in groups. They're working in teams. They're collaborating. They're reporting on experiments. And they're really getting hands-on to show them how science really works.
You're a private company. I assume, correct? You're selling your services that way?
Yes. Yep. Definitely a private company.
And then what's the upshot here? I mean, so then what happens? What's the hope, other than entertaining the kids, educate them a little bit? What's the big picture?
Well, the big picture, you were talking about tech and kind of the U.S. keeping its tech edge. Well, these are the kids that are going to do that. So why STEM education is so important now and always really has been is the job market. It's becoming increasingly tech and science focused. Like one of your callers or one of your guests previously was talking about things like ChatGPT, TikTok. All of those are science focused, tech focused. So programs like ours, offered by Mad Science of Chicago, really help engage young learners, and they prepare them for the future. So science is a toolbox, right? It fosters critical thinking, it helps with problem solving, and creativity. Scientists are some of the most creative people on the planet. So those are really 21st century skills that we need to put into the hands of our kids so that they can engage in all the tech-focused things that, you know, all of our industries need.
We have to wrap this up, but just one last comment. You're a woman, and I would hope that more young girls would see you as a model, or you know, or believe that they can do this too.
I sure hope so. So we've got a long way to go to boost representation in STEM careers, but we have a mighty team at Mad Science of women and scientists and engineers and educators, and we're really working to break down those barriers to show that traditionally, maybe STEM careers were not female-oriented, but geez, they sure need to be. So we really try and empower all kids, regardless of gender, income, where they grew up, where they be, to really head into STEM, because it's exciting stuff to explore.
Let's go, boys and girls. Chicago.madscience.org for Sharon King. She's a curriculum expert at Mad Science. You betcha. Thanks for joining us.